Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're looking into something really fascinating, a deeply ingrained aspect of Kurdish culture. The tradition of body marking known as dek, or sometimes zal.
Yes, and we've gathered quite a collection of sources looking into the, you know, the history, the symbolism, the actual techniques, and just the huge cultural weight of these marks. They're mostly found on women historically, but men were part of it too.
So our goal today is really to get a handle on this practice, understand its different layers, and how it's journeyed from, well, ancient times right up to the present day, where it's seeing a kind of revival.
Exactly. We want to explore what these markings can tell us, you know, about Kurdish identity, about spirituality, resilience, the whole picture.
Okay, let's unpack this. You mentioned ancient times. Just how far back are we talking? Where do the earliest roots lie?
It seems incredibly old. The practice is tied to ancient Mesopotamia. Some researchers even suggest it might go back as far as 10,000 years.
10,000? Really?
Okay. It's a staggering thought, isn't it? It puts this tradition right alongside some of the earliest human civilizations. And that longevity suggests these marks met some pretty fundamental human needs over a vast amount of time.
So this is way before Islam, before many major shifts in the region.
Oh, absolutely. It's understood to predate Islam, and it seems woven into pre-Islamic beliefs. Things like Zoroastrianism, Yazidi cosmology. You can sort of see traces of those ancient worldviews in the symbols themselves.
Interesting. Like the sun symbol, maybe?
Precisely. The importance of the sun in dek could well echo the reverence for light you find in Zoroastrianism.
Do we have actual written records from back then? Or close to it?
We do have some early glimpses from outside observers. There's Aegeus of Amida, a Byzantine Greek doctor in the 6th century. He actually described how tattoo pigments were prepared in the region, and it sounds pretty similar to some dek methods.
So even 1,500 years ago, people were noticing and writing about this. What about later accounts?
Well, jump forward quite a bit to the 19th and 20th centuries. European travelers, anthropologists, they started documenting it more systematically. Jacques de Morgan, for instance, wrote in the 1890s about seeing older Kurdish women with extensive tattoos, sometimes covering a lot of their bodies. He noted men usually had them on their hands.
Right. And Henry Field saw similar things in Iran in the 1950s.
Yes, he did. It's useful information, though you always have to remember it's an outsider's view they're giving us.
Good point. Now, one scholar, Mirdad Izadi, he proposes a really deep connection, doesn't he? Back to the Bronze Age.
Yes, Izadi's idea is fascinating. He suggests that some common dek motifs, things like snakes, sun disks, dogs, even combs, look remarkably similar to symbols found on ancient Hurrian figurines.
Wow, Hurrian. So we're talking maybe 3,000-4,000 years ago?
Exactly. If he's right, it suggests this symbolic language, this visual vocabulary, has been passed down for millennia, an incredible continuity.
A visual language lasting thousands of years. That's powerful. But as you said, these early accounts are external.
That's key. They give us historical markers, but they might miss the nuances, the deeper meanings, especially the ones shared perhaps more privately, particularly among women. That's why the more recent ethnographic work, talking directly to people within the culture, is so crucial. It gets us closer to the lived experience of dek.
Okay, so incredibly deep roots, possibly Mesopotamian, evolving over time. Let's shift to the meaning. What did these marks actually say? Clearly more than just decoration.
Oh, absolutely. Dek is this incredibly rich symbolic system. Think of it as a visual language on the skin. The motifs mostly come from nature, the stars, daily life objects, and they're packed with meaning, reflecting beliefs, hopes, cultural values.
It's like a personal story etched onto the body.
In a very real sense, yes. For many women, their dek was like a diary, you know, marking significant life events, experiences.
Let's get into some specifics. The sun, Raj, you mentioned it earlier. That seems really central.
It is. Very common, often on the forehead. It generally stands for life, light, the sacred, wishing for a long, healthy life.
And other celestial symbols, moons, stars.
Yep, heaven, Steren. They often represent the sky, beauty, maybe cosmic balance or harmony.
There's also the tree of life. That sounds incredibly symbolic.
It really is. You often see it on women, sometimes running from the chest up to the chin. It speaks to immortality, continuity, family lines, fertility, health, that deep connection to ancestors and the earth.
Nature seems to be a huge source of inspiration here.
Definitely. Animals are everywhere. The gazelle, gazal, often means beauty, grace, maybe luck. Birds can be freedom or messengers. Snakes, marin, might be about healing or protection.
Even potentially dangerous animals, like scorpions.
Even scorpions. A crepe, They could symbolize heroism, maybe mystery, sometimes even healing too. Or partridge eyes, grace, beauty, but also being aware of danger.
Fascinating. And plant life.
Yes, lots of floral motifs. Flowers, wheat stalks, tulips, roses, usually tied to fertility, abundance, natural beauty.
What about the geometric patterns? Dots, crosses, diamonds. They seem more abstract.
They're fundamental. Dots, often in threes, are really important strength, stability, protection against the evil eye, the nazar. Sometimes even used for headaches, like on the temples.
Okay.
Crosses were often used to ward off bad spirits. Diamonds could signify strength, circles often linked to fertility. Sometimes a specific shape, like a V, might even indicate which tribe someone belonged to.
And things from daily life, like combs or mirrors.
Right, the Tarak and Aina, usually linked to beauty, femininity, or the pack, the crown shape, often on the forehead, suggesting leadership, honesty, nobility.
So it's this complex web of symbols, and you mentioned the Redemiet tattoo earlier. On the lip.
Yes, that one's interesting. It's seen particularly in Turkish Kurdistan and seems to be adopted from Arab women's traditions, often associated with Hurs Fatima. It shows how these traditions interact and borrow, creating layers of meaning, a cultural palimpsest, as some call it.
And one symbol could mean different things depending on context.
Exactly. They're polysemic. The meaning isn't totally fixed. It depends on who wore it, where it was placed, the specific community's understanding. It's a dynamic system.
It really sounds like a living language.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about how it was actually done. Very different from modern tattooing, I gather.
Completely different. Traditional dek is all manual, hand-poked or hand-tapped. The name dek itself means to strike or tap. No electric machines involved.
Hand-poked. Sounds painful and probably took a long time.
It likely did. The tools were simple, needles, often a bundle of maybe seven tied together, sometimes little metal points. And the person getting the tattoo had a name, Medkuk for a woman, Medkuk for a man.
And the ink. That sounds really unique, especially the part about breast milk.
Yes, the ink is one of the most distinctive parts. The base was usually soot, often lamp black, from burning rags or maybe pomegranate peel mixed with human breast milk.
And not just any breast milk, right?
Right. There was the strong belief, very widespread, that it had to be milk from a woman who'd had a baby girl. Milk from a mother of a boy was sometimes thought to be unlucky, or that the tattoo wouldn't take as well or last as long.
That's incredibly specific. What's the thinking behind that?
It seems to tie the whole process deeply into female procreative power, into matrilineal continuity. It gives the ink this sacred, gendered significance. It's not just pigment. It's carrying something powerful.
Were other things ever mixed in?
There are reports of other ingredients, sometimes animal bile, certain herbs. Suggests regional differences, maybe changes over time. And remember that 6th century recipe from Aetius.
Yeah.
That mentioned things like crushed pine wood and bronze. So the recipes definitely weren't static.
And this knowledge, how to make the ink, how to do the tapping, it was passed down.
Often matrilineally, yes, from mother to daughter or aunt to niece. It really underscores how central women were to keeping this tradition alive.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosch, Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Roj Bosch.
Let's see what we've got today. Pause for a sipping sound. You know, it's a little bit bitter today, isn't it? Could use a touch more sugar, I think. Still lovely and warm, though. A welcome break.
Agreed. Short pause for chai break.
Okay. All right, back to it. So we've covered the deep history, the amazing symbolism, the traditional methods. Now let's talk about the wider role dek played in Kurdish society. Sounds like it touched almost every part of life.
It really did. It wasn't just skin deep, so to speak. It was woven into the social fabric, the culture, the spirituality. It was about identity, ancestors, gender, protection, healing, so many things.
Let's start with identity and belonging. It seems like a very visible badge of being Kurdish.
Absolutely. A clear, visible marker of cultural identity, a connection to heritage. For many Kurds today, especially in the diaspora, getting dek or studying it is about connecting with ancestors.
And historically, it could signify more specific things too, like your tribe.
Yes, definitely. Specific patterns or placements could signal which tribe you belong to, maybe your lineage, or just what region you are from. In oral cultures, these visible markers are incredibly important for transmitting identity across generations.
Like wearing your history and community connections on your skin.
Exactly. And for women, as we said, it was often a personal chronicle too, marking life stages, becoming a woman, getting married, having children.
Which brings us back to gender.
Right.
It seems so strongly associated with women, performed by women, passed down by women.
Overwhelmingly so. Beyond marking life stages and being seen as beautification, some feminist perspectives see it as a form of female agency.
Agency? How so?
Well, in a patriarchal society, having this domain deck that was largely controlled by women, performed by women, knowledge held by women, it created a space for female expression, for bonding. It was a way of, perhaps subtly, claiming some ownership over their bodies, expressing individuality.
Interesting. Almost a form of quiet resistance or assertion.
You could interpret it that way. There were even some beliefs, maybe not everywhere, but they existed that certain tattoos could influence a husband, maybe prevent him from taking a second wife. Whether it worked is another matter, but the belief itself speaks volumes about female concerns and desires within that structure.
Right. Now, what about the spiritual side? Protection seemed key.
Hugely important. For some, getting deck was almost an act of worship, prayers for fertility, blessings, abundance, and protection was central. Warding off the evil eye, the Nazar, was a major function.
So specific symbols or placements were thought to offer safety.
Yes. Safety in general. Protection during pregnancy and childbirth. Even protection in battle, though that was likely more relevant for the men who sometimes had deck.
And it wasn't just spiritual protection. There was a healing aspect, too.
Definitely. We mentioned the dots on the temples for migraines. Other accounts talk about using deck for things like rheumatism, numbness, even cracked lips. There was a belief it could help cure diseases, boost immunity, maybe even prolong life.
It sounds almost like an early form of maybe acupressure, but with symbols.
It's an interesting comparison. The idea that marking specific points on the body with these potent symbols could have real physical and spiritual effects was clearly deeply ingrained.
Now, Kurdistan is a large area, culturally diverse. Did deck look the same everywhere?
Not at all. You find it across southeastern Turkey, northern Iraq, northern Syria, western Iran, but with definite regional variations. Different motifs might be popular, or the same symbol might have slightly different meanings.
Like the red hemiate lip tattoo being more common in Turkish Kurdistan.
Exactly. And that one shows the borrowing from Arab traditions, as we discussed. Or look at Yazidi Kurds. Their deck shares a lot with other Kurds, but they also have unique symbols reflecting their own religious beliefs. More sun symbols, maybe specific patterns like the Dakaya or Sestak.
So comparing deck between Kurdish groups and even with neighboring groups like Arabs or Assyrians shows both shared cultural currents and distinct identities.
Precisely. It connects Kurds to a wider regional aesthetic, but also helps mark out what makes Kurdish identity or specific Kurdish religious identities like Yazidism unique. The nomadic history of many Kurdish communities probably also played a role in this diversity to fare. Less centralization meant more regional variation could flourish.
So you really need to appreciate that diversity when studying D. It wasn't monolithic.
Not at all. Lots of micro-regional expressions.
It's amazing it persisted so widely.
Uh-huh.
But sources say it declined significantly in the last century or so. Why did that happen?
It's a mix of factors, really. Certain interpretations of Islam discouraging permanent tattoos definitely played a big part. Then there's modernization, Western beauty standards coming in, making traditional practices seem, you know, old-fashioned to some. And also political pressures for assimilation in the states Kurds live in.
A combination of religious shifts, cultural changes, and politics. So today it's mostly older women who still have these traditional tattoos.
Yes, they're often called the last guardians of the tradition. You don't see young people getting deck in the traditional way nearly as much.
Boyd, there's a revival happening. That sounds hopeful.
It really is. There's a very vibrant movement, especially among younger Kurds, both in the homeland and maybe even more strongly in the diaspora. It's driven by this real desire to reconnect with their heritage, to push back against that assimilation pressure and reassert Kurdish identity.
Who's leading this? Are there artists involved?
Yes, absolutely. Contemporary artists, researchers, cultural activists, people like Ilu Ayana, Fatma Temel, they're actively practicing deck, researching its history and meanings, and bringing it back into the public eye.
How are they doing that? What kind of work is involved?
A lot of things. Really crucial work is documenting the knowledge of those remaining elders, recording their stories, archiving the motifs before they're lost. They're using social media, exhibitions, documentaries to educate people.
And what motivates them, do you think?
It seems very personal for many. A spiritual connection, feeling like they're communicating with their ancestors. But also, it's a very visible way to express Kurdish identity today. And there's a sense of responsibility ensuring this art form survives for the next generation. The diaspora involvement is huge here.
Is the revived deck exactly the same as the old ways?
There are adaptations. Some are trying to use the traditional hand poke methods, even trying to recreate the traditional inks. Others use modern stick-and-poke tools, or even machines sometimes, but focus on using the traditional symbols and understanding their meaning. Some might use temporary markings, too, navigating those religious concerns.
So it's evolving, finding ways to exist in the modern world.
Exactly. And academic work like Amit Yavuklu's research and institutional support like the British Council's DEC exhibition, that all helps to validate and support the revival. It's a combined effort.
The story of Kurdish DEC really is incredible. Such a powerful example of cultural resilience. These marks carry so much history, so much meaning.
From those ancient Mesopotamian roots, right through millennia, to this contemporary resurgence. It just shows the tenacity of Kurdish culture and identity.
It really makes you think about embodied heritage history written on the skin and the crucial role of women in carrying these traditions forward. It's a living dialogue between past and present.
And the drive to keep it alive, it really speaks to that fundamental human need we all have, doesn't it? To connect with where we come from, to express who we are as part of a community, a culture.
We really hope this exploration gave you a richer feel for this unique part of Kurdish culture. Thinking about everything we've discussed, you know, the symbolism, the pressures, the revival, what other stories might be hidden in plain sight, written on the skin, or embedded in the practices of different cultures around the world? What other secret languages are out there waiting for us to understand? Definitely something to ponder as you continue your own explorations.